have changed. Just think about it. I travel for business, as did my great-grandfather. True, I travel in a comfortable leather seat in a jet airliner while he traveled in a wagon. It is also true that I travel enormous distances relatively quickly and in comparative comfort, while he endured grueling travel between neighboring towns. Yet, I spend roughly the same number of days away from my home and family each month as he did. While traveling, he missed his loved ones and the little comforts of home just as much as I do while on the road. I hope that my travel will result in revenue to my family just as longingly as did my great-grandfather. And while sleeping in a strange bed in a distant Sheraton is certainly far more pleasant than on a pile of straw in the corner of the loft of a rural German inn, my traveling life is not that different from the one my great-grandfather experienced. Today, most people work for about a third of every 24-hour period. They sleep for approximately another third of the day, and the remaining third goes by in taking care of the auxiliary aspects of living. That is almost exactly how people a century ago divided up their days. Is sitting before a computer monitor so very different from the work they did back then? Well, yes and no. It is far more pleasant than working in a claustrophobic and unhealthy factory. But work is work. It means doing what you must do instead of what you might prefer to be doing. Were your great-grandparents to return to witness your life, they might well be surprised at how little things have changed. If they are surprised at all, they might well be more surprised by social changes than by technology. It is easy to mistake change for more than it really is. Change is reality. But what kind of reality? The reality of change is depicted more accurately by a video than by a snapshot. The old Greek philosopher Zeno confounded all his contemporaries by presenting this conundrum. An audacious tortoise once challenged the famous runner Achilles to a race. The tortoise demanded a head start of 100 yards. Photograph the scene showing the tortoise ahead of Achilles by 100 yards. At the starter's signal, Achilles, who runs 10 times faster than the tortoise, sets off and quickly covers 100 yards, reaching the point from which the tortoise began. By that time, the tortoise, running at 1/10 of Achilles' speed, has run another 10 yards. Photograph the scene again, showing that this time the tortoise is still ahead, but by 10 yards. By the time Achilles covers that additional 10 yards, which is to say reaches the 110-yard point, the tortoise is now 1 yard ahead of Achilles, since he still runs 1/10 as fast as the human. Photograph the scene again, memorializing the fact that the tortoise is still in the lead. By the time the human runner has covered that additional 1 yard, the tortoise is now 1/10 of a yard ahead of Achilles. Time for another snapshot. No matter how many snapshots are taken, they will always show Achilles lagging behind the tortoise. While it is true that the lead enjoyed by the tortoise in each successive photo is a diminishing one, he does seem to remain the leader, and thus eventually the winner. Obviously, Zeno and his wily friends knew that Achilles would eventually win a race against the tortoise. What bothered them about this paradox was that they could not find the catch. The catch is that real life is not reflected accurately by a series of snapshots. It is correctly depicted only by a smooth and continuously running video. Watching a video of the race between Achilles and the tortoise would quickly have shown the runner outpacing the tortoise at a little more than 111 yards from the start. It is easy to be confused or even misled when trying to interpret reality with a sequence of snapshots. In the same way, you could examine a snapshot of 10 workers struggling to get by on minimum wage. It is not a pretty picture. However, if you revisited these workers 6 months later, if they had kept their jobs and worked on improving their skills, you would find that most would be earning somewhat more for their work. Government statisticians would have to locate another 10 workers to produce a snapshot showing 10 Americans that are still on minimum wage. Although it is true that there are still 10 workers on minimum wage, it is surely not irrelevant that they are a different set of 10 people, and that the first 10 are now moving up the economic escalator. There are only 3 job skills necessary to find and keep an entry-level job. First, show up regularly and on time. Second, obey instructions. Third, speak and act respectfully. These are character attributes rather than real work skills, and they can be acquired from parents or from an employer who really cares far more easily than they can be acquired from any job training program. Almost anybody obeying these 3 rules in the United States can find an entry-level job and keep it. By keeping the position, one quickly becomes trained and worth more to an employer. An employee who has learned his way around the job and acquired the job-specific skills cannot be replaced by a new entry-level person. The experienced employee is worth more to his employer than any newcomer. And most intelligent employers, recognizing this obvious fact, will pay him more in order to keep him. The employer has something invested in the employee, and certainly does not want him leaving for the competitor down the road who would also offer him the minimum wage. Thus, the fortunate newcomer to the job market finds himself on the economic escalator. The snapshot of him from 6 months earlier is now meaningless. Similarly, a snapshot of a successful lawyer photographed a year before she graduates law school may well show someone apparently in need of government assistance. The snapshot will show a young woman working, well, okay, studying, all day without being paid a penny. She may live in one little room that she shares with another student. She may subsist on macaroni and cheese. The snapshot demands a compassionate response from anyone seeing it, but it fails to show that this woman is only months away from earning an enviable income and in absolutely no need of help from anyone. Least of all should she extract assistance from middle-income families whose total income is considerably less than she will earn in her first year with a prestigious law firm. People often view misleading snapshots such as these and become convinced that higher taxes are necessary to help the poor. There may be poor, but it is a dynamic group, just as there are children, but they are not the same people who were children 10 years ago. It is not surprising that, as reported in Forbes magazine on May 4, 1998, shelters for the poor compete for homeless people in order to justify their budgets. Grand Central Neighborhood Social Services Corporation in New York City even ran a marketing special during November 1997 to engage new clients by offering a free breakfast and $5 in cash. What better way to get good people to agree to higher taxes than to play on their natural and biblically inspired compassion for the poor? All that's needed for this scam to work are lots of warm bodies labeled the poor, who can be paraded before the well-intentioned and gullible, who then nobly open their wallets. Are there people who have far less than many other people? Of course there are. Is this a fatal flaw in the entire U.S. socioeconomic system? No, it isn't, because many of them are only poor when viewed with a snapshot rather than a video of reality. Snapshots conceal reality. They don't reveal it. Jews have traditionally benefited economically by their intuitive rejection of the snapshot view of the world and the mass manipulation it allows. Religious Jews were always more likely to view life through a video rather than through a dishonest sequence of snapshots. Their familiarity with the Bible's approach to recounting events accustomed them to seeing the moving timeline of history and to the ever-repeating biblical laws of cause and effect. Jewish faith educated its devotees to distrust superficial appearances. Show them a snapshot depicting an attractive-looking couple strolling hand in hand, and they instinctively ask themselves questions. They wonder whether this is a devoted married couple anticipating many happy years in one another's loving company, or an extramarital couple caught in a moment of adulterous bliss. They just do not know from the photograph, and are not prepared to celebrate their evident joy until they see the video. Jews want to see what led to this moment, and what follows from it. They never take a snapshot at its face value. Through always thinking video, and not snapshot in this way, genuinely compassionate and charitable religious Jews are far less vulnerable to the politics of poverty. They recognize that not a single person has everything he or she needs or wants, and therefore poverty is more a state of mind than a state of pocket. Jews also recognize that self-discipline and biblical principles of ethical capitalism are the stepping stones to a family's economic growth. Another key to how Jews view the role of past and future and how they impact their experience of the present is provided by the total absence of any present verb, to be, in Hebrew. Anyone speaking a grammatically and biblically correct Hebrew can say, I will be here tomorrow. Or she can also say, I was here yesterday. Although there are phrases that are accepted to mean, I am here now, in actuality the verb to be doesn't exist in a usable form. While Israelis work around this dilemma, allowing the conventions of everyday speech to be maintained, Jews, as well as many others who consider Hebrew to be the Lord's language, recognize that He, in His wisdom, decreed that there is effectively no such thing as the present. The present moment, rather than a true moment of reality right now, is instead a mathematical creation of Isaac Newton and Gottfried Leibniz. When each separately perceived the bright truth of the calculus, he was giving birth to a way of quantifying and relating to that now that is subjectively felt to be the present. In reality, the present is no more than an experiential mechanism by means of which humans can convert the future into the past. That's right. The present is not so much a time as it is an action. The present is the activity I am currently engaged in during every instant with the purpose of turning the infinitely malleable future into a better past. Correctly understanding how the present instant is less real than the past or the future can also help people deal with fear. As important as it is to be future-focused, it is also important to remember that fear only exists in the future. Although it is unhealthy and impractical to live only in and for the present instant, it is not hard to see that those who do live this way experience very little fear. If all that counts is the present instant, there can be nothing approaching from the future to hurt you. This is a psychological defense mechanism that humans evoke during moments of extreme physical peril. Soldiers in action often speak of reaching an exultant phase of activity in which all fear abandons them. The present crisis in which they find themselves obscures all thought of the future, and along with that, it obscures all fear. You obviously cannot eliminate all thoughts of the future, neither should you try. On the contrary, your success to some extent depends on your ability to accurately read the future. However, in dealing with fear, shifting your focus just a little from the future to the present helps deflect the paralyzing effects of fear. Recognizing this truth about the present makes change easier to deal with and easier to manipulate to your benefit. Remember the mantra, "Everything is constantly in motion, and change is perpetual." For some approaching changes, as for a fast-approaching and difficult ball in baseball, I must step backward to give myself more room to swing at it. For other approaching changes, as for a sweet, slow lob, I must step forward to embrace and exploit it as quickly as possible. The trick, of course, is telling the difference between the two. For that trick, two useful props exist. One, recognizing and remaining anchored to those things that never change. And two, improving your ability to see future trends that so influence just how you should best modify the present instant. The next chapter shows how you can more accurately foretell the future. Your path to prosperity. Understand that the Star of David represents a strong life view that helps deal with change. The first triangle, standing firmly on its base, represents the core aspects of life that do not change and on which you can depend, while everything else around you may shift and take on new and unfamiliar forms. The second triangle, upside down and balanced precariously on its point, signifies the natural and technological world in which each passing year adds to your store of knowledge and control. Accept innovation and embrace change. The choice is either to accept innovation along with the pain it may cause some people, or to reject it and ensure poverty and pain for almost everyone. You should cling to the firm pilings of the unchangeable and resist being swept away by the maelstroms that swirl around your very foundations. Change can be frightening and painful, but there is no way to hold back this progress. You need the ability to let go of the old and embrace the new. Not being taken by surprise is a great benefit. Try to absorb and make changes gradually. Set aside some time each morning, say 20 minutes or so, as a stress equalization period. Read something not directly work-related. Ruminate over your longer-term goals, or merely meditate spiritually. Thereafter, proceed with your workout at the gym, or your breakfast, or whatever else comes next as you prepare for the day's work. This will help you ease into the day instead of abruptly embarking on the day's work. Do your best to avoid two or more simultaneous stress-inducing changes in your life. If you are planning on a major move, say to another city, don't schedule your wedding for the same week. If you unexpectedly lose your job, postpone the surgery you had planned for the same period until you have had a chance to absorb and adjust to the career change. Create a file in your computer or on a dedicated page in your organizer on which you make, modify, and maintain a list of those things that never change for you. Those constitute the anchor that will hold your ship steady, regardless of how violently the gale howls or how high the waves threaten to hurl you. You can reach me at the address at the end of this book if you would like free worksheets that will help you compile this list. Keep in mind your core values as an individual and in your business. These should never change, regardless of the technological developments or market changes that are occurring around you. The Seventh Commandment. Learn to foretell the future. Who is wise? one who can tell what will be hatched from the egg that has been laid. Not he who can see the future, that is a prophet. Wisdom is seeing tomorrow's consequences of today's events. Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Tamid. During the year immediately preceding my worst business failure, all I saw was sunshine and good times ahead. Many investors eagerly clambered aboard my swiftly growing enterprise. Potential partners sought participation. Things could hardly have looked more promising. Our company's growth rate was so heady that with no hesitation I violated the rule of diversification by placing virtually all my eggs into one basket. I invested all my assets into my own business on the assumption that no one else would look after it all as diligently as I would. Then an exciting acquisition opportunity came up, and I consulted a man who was the name partner of a professional firm, a person whom I considered to be perhaps the wisest businessman in California. He listened to my presentation and spent about 5 minutes paging through my spreadsheets. Then he passed all my material back across his desk to me, leaned back in his chair, and began to speak. I had such confidence in his judgment that, on hearing his words, I felt as if I had been hit by an express train. "Your company will be out of business soon," he said. He must have seen the look of shock on my face, for he continued, "I cannot help you with the strategy you propose. It would be futile. But when you need me to help you wind everything down tidily, I'll be available." I thanked him a little coolly and walked out of his office more resolute than ever to complete successfully the acquisition I had planned. A few months later, California began to experience one of its worst real estate downturns ever. Its economy languished, and hundreds of businesses, both large and small, failed, including mine. That I had not seen the faintest hint of the gloomy future was mortifying enough. What made it so much harder to bear was a man that I respected had seen my impending doom with complete clarity long before that time. While trying to emerge from the wreckage of my hopes, I resolved to ruthlessly examine why I had so fatally failed to see the future. Some people can see the future more clearly than others. Let me hasten to add that this wise and far-seeing business professional was accomplished at seeing only the future of a business. He was entirely without prescience, for instance, when it came to the disastrous marriage of his son, which he had originally encouraged ardently. No one can see the future clearly when one's emotions are involved. Therefore, one of the clues to becoming accomplished at seeing the future is to learn how to disengage one's own emotions. This is very difficult, and is surely one of the reasons that most medical professionals do not attend to their own close relatives. Wise doctors recognize how difficult it would be to disengage their emotional involvement with their spouse or their children. Consequently, they correctly doubt their own vision of a problem's future course and the proposed treatment. They would rather that a trusted colleague to whom the relative is merely a patient performs the diagnosis and treatment. Different people really do possess different abilities at seeing the future, just as different people possess different abilities at playing the piano or making omelets. But as with cooking or music, it is relatively easy to greatly enhance one's ability in any field through training and practice. You may never become a concert pianist or a great chef, but you will become far more capable than you had been prior to training yourself. Recognize when external events will affect your business or life. Further into this chapter, I will show you how to improve your ability at forecasting the future impact of current events. For now, it is sufficient that you understand two facts. First, some coming events can cause real change that will impact your business, yet leave other kinds of businesses immune. Whereas other future events will not affect your activities, but might well disrupt those of someone else. Second, you should never procrastinate in the face of the former, and you should refuse to be stampeded by the latter. Newt Gingrich, for example, failed to see this difference. Gingrich was a professor in Georgia before he entered politics and became the Speaker of the House in 1994, and he was passionately interested in educational problems in the United States. In 1996, as the Internet began to enter the national consciousness, Gingrich told me that he thought the Internet would totally end America's educational crisis. He was, of course, wrong. The Internet has not contributed to any improvement in the academic performance of U.S. high school students, and it is unlikely to do so. He would have been correct if he had predicted that the Internet would bring about as much change to the economy as did the railroads back in the 1850s, when two-thirds of all public offerings were railroad stocks. The Internet dramatically impacted the U.S. economy and continues to do so, but it has had almost no effect on teenage literacy. In other words, if you work for a tech company, or own one, or if you sell investments or advise on them, the Internet causes change that should concern you. If you drive a taxi, you don't need to be equally concerned. If you are in the dry cleaning business or the auto repair business, you should watch pending environmental regulations very carefully. If you sell software, you can afford to be much less vigilant monitoring environmental regulations. Interpret events without emotion. Seeing the future has little to do with native skills or intelligence. Many highly educated individuals are conspicuously unsuccessful at predicting the future. Other people with no apparent educational advantage possess what seem to be almost supernatural abilities to see the future. Two statesmen who presented a marvelous contrast in prescience were Winston Churchill and Neville Chamberlain. Here is what Churchill wrote about Chamberlain. He had formed decided judgments about all the political figures of the day, both at home and abroad, and felt himself capable of dealing with them. His all-pervading hope was to go down in history as the great peacemaker, and for this he was prepared to strive continually in the teeth of facts and face great risks for himself and his country. Unhappily, he ran into tides the force of which he could not measure, and met hurricanes from which he did not flinch, but with which he could not cope. In September 1938, Neville Chamberlain had visited with a dictator he obsequiously referred to as the Honorable Herr Hitler in Munich. On returning to England, Chamberlain exited his airplane at Heston Aerodrome, waved his infamous umbrella triumphantly, and held up the joint declaration he had gotten Hitler to sign. From the windows of his office at Downing Street, he again waved the paper at a crowd fearful of war and used these words. "This is the second time there has come back from Germany to Downing Street peace with honor. I believe it is peace in our time." Within only one short year, England was engaged in a mortal struggle for her very survival. Chamberlain had turned out to be a very poor prophet, whereas all that Churchill had warned of came to pass with uncanny accuracy. One of the secrets to Churchill's ability to see the future was that he kept his emotions at bay. Unlike Chamberlain, whose own sense of ego was notoriously wrapped up within his political persona, and unlike Hitler, whose frequent public ranting testified to his emotionalism, Churchill was disarmingly indifferent to his public image. Many dignitaries recall mid-morning meetings conducted in Winston Churchill's bedroom, with the great man himself propped up on his pillows while wearing his yellow pajamas. Few ever saw the pajamas of Chamberlain or Hitler. Ego is one enemy of effective futurism. Learn to overcome it, and you will be well on the way to seeing the future far more clearly. Let me assure you that I doubt it is within one's power to become prophetic across the board and to see the future of everything. It is, however, completely possible to train oneself to become adept at seeing the future in one or two areas. Because in this book I am discussing wealth creation, it would be advantageous to focus on foresight in the area of business. Being personally and emotionally involved can definitely obstruct attempts to appear into the future. But that is not all that makes the task difficult. When glimpses of the future are dark and dim, as they usually are, brilliant peripheral light can also obscure a clear picture of what you strain to make out. When driving at night, you try to block out the blinding glare from headlights of oncoming cars, and when squinting into the future, you must do the same. George Shaheen, for example, was a wise business professional. He had been a professional fortune teller for 32 years, advising businesses about what lay ahead of them and what they should do about it. He headed the legendary Anderson Consulting Company, which, during the 1990s, was earning revenues of close to $10 billion a year. If anyone should have been able to foresee the future, it was Shaheen. But, less than a year before his lavish retirement package would have triggered, Shaheen left Anderson Consulting and joined internet grocery startup Webvan in September 1999. He obtained options to purchase over 10 million shares of Webvan before its initial public offering, along with other generous compensation and equity inducements. Unfortunately, Webvan had lost $35 million in just the first 6 months of 1999, and announced its expectation to have operating losses for the foreseeable future, just like many other web firms. What was shocking was the speed with which Webvan collapsed. By spring 2001, Shaheen stepped down from his position as Chief Executive Officer, CEO, and was left without a job. With a pile of underwater, valueless options, and even without the lifetime annual payments that had been promised him regardless of his stay at Webvan. By that summer, Webvan had filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. "I can only tell you that we did the best we could," Shaheen told CNET's Greg Sandoval. "Look around. This whole space got clobbered. No one foresaw what was going to happen." Wrong. Although most people certainly did not foresee what was going to happen, some did see exactly what was going to happen. Those who did sold Webvan short. They were people who had no emotional connection to Webvan. To them, it was just another stock. They were not in love with the Internet. They were in love with accurate investment analysis. They were also people who blocked out the bright lights of lavish capitalization that would have spoiled their night vision. And that is what seeing the future is most like, peering out at the nighttime gloom from inside a well-lighted room. It is hard, but not impossible. Naturally, looking backward in time is most similar to looking through the window into a well-lit room while standing outside in the dark night. That is easy. Anyone can do it. Ever since Aristotle, people have thought that you can see stars at midday from the bottom of a well. In reality, descending down a shaft will not allow you to see stars during the daylight hours. But the theory wasn't crazy. The idea was that by blocking out all the bright extraneous daylight, the faint speck of starlight would become visible. Fortunately, in attempting to glimpse the faint flecks that indicate the future, the principle of blocking out bright extraneous light works very well. How could the crystal ball of the oracle to whom so many had turned for a glimpse into the future have gone so dark? George Shaheen was far from the only smart and experienced business professional to have been blinded by the incandescent flashes bursting from the Internet. Any excessively bright lighting makes it difficult, if not impossible, to make out details in the dark corners of the room. Learn to see clues in the present that foreshadow the future. Time is fascinating. The instinctive desire to seize the present instant and keep it alive, the way people cherish memories and seek to preserve them with the aid of millions of photographic images and miles of videotape, and that staple of science fiction fantasies of time travel. Experiencing the present and recalling the past are all good, but not nearly as intriguing as seeing the future. People are drawn to those who call the future accurately, whether they successfully predict the rise or the fall of stock prices or coming events. It is unfortunate that because people are accustomed to dismissing the carnival clairvoyant as a charlatan, they tend also to dismiss every aspect of seeing the future. They feel that anything less than complete rejection of futurism would cast aspersions on their rationality. In reality, a full understanding of time and its role in life requires nothing less than full rationality. Intuition may work with quantities, such as length and weight, that are used to define the physical environment. Regardless of the activity in which I am engaged, and regardless of my age, I can pretty much guesstimate the length of a table, or even of a bridge. Like almost everyone else, I can also come up with a fairly good estimate of the dimensions of a box, and after picking it up, a weight that will be close enough for many purposes. However, estimating how much time has elapsed since a particular event or a particular moment is far more difficult. To a child, a year is almost endless, but to his middle-aged parent, a year flies by with frightening speed. You might explain this by saying that, well, time is relative. Relative to a child's life experience of perhaps only 10 years, a passing year is a full 10% of her experience. To the adult, however, the same year is a far smaller fragment of her life experience. Thus it feels far shorter. This may be a true and convincing explanation, but no similar explanation is even needed for quantities like weight and volume. When I'm working on an aggravating business or financial problem, time drags. The same period spent enjoying a long-awaited vacation can vanish with bewildering rapidity. This is not the only strange thing about time. For instance, I can experience an entire table, bridge, or box at the same time, but only a fleeting instant of any event. For the remainder of the event, I must depend on memory and on a matching faculty. Sensing the future. I do this all the time without even thinking of it. I have learned to interpret the clues of the present in order to predict the approaching future. Suppose I take a shortcut across a golf course one fine day when I hear the clear crack of a club connecting with a ball. I then hear someone yelling, "Four!" I immediately throw myself to the ground in the hope of avoiding concussion. My deaf friend is astonished to see a small white projectile come whizzing through the space that until an instant earlier had been occupied by my head. Using sign language, I explain to him that although completely capable in so many areas, he is unable to pick up the clues on a golf course that suggest the imminent arrival of a fast-moving golf ball. Because his handicapped reality is normal for him and is all he has ever known, he looks at me as some kind of prophet. Now imagine a family picnicking on the banks of a large pond one very misty day. One little boy detaches himself from the group and wanders a few feet down to the water's edge. Suddenly he calls out to his family, "Quick, look! In a few moments you're going to see ripples on the water." Sure enough, after a few seconds, ripples appear out of the mist and roll in toward where the amazed family sits. "How did you know?" they ask. By wandering down to the water, he had isolated himself from the hubbub of noise generated by the happy picnic, and that allowed him to hear a faint splash. He correctly interpreted as someone on the far side of the pond, hidden by the mist, tossing a pebble into the pond. He reasoned that if he was right, the ripples from the pebble would soon arrive. Had the boy not provided the simple explanation for his apparent prescience, he would have looked like a prophet. Cicero said, "It was ordained at the beginning of the world that certain signs should prefigure certain events." Whether you perceive those signs as listening for the faint footsteps of approaching events, or whether you prefer to think of them as looking out for the shadows that coming events cast before them, matters not at all. What matters is only that you realize two facts. One, within obvious limitations, seeing the future is quite possible. And two, you can improve your ability to see it. Look backward to see forward. Isaac Newton's first law of motion also serves very well as the first law of seeing the future. In 1686, Newton specified that any object will tend to continue doing whatever it is then doing unless it is acted on by some external force. If a stationary vehicle is parked at the curb, it is going to want to remain there unless a driver starts the engine and engages the gears, or unless someone gives it a mighty shove. Likewise, if the car is traveling smoothly down the freeway at 60 miles an hour, it will want to continue doing so unless air resistance and other frictions slow it down, or unless the driver stomps on the brake or the accelerator. In the absence of any of these outside forces, and in the real world they are never really quite absent, the car would indeed continue traveling at 60 miles an hour indefinitely. By the way, when a driver does stomp on the brakes of a fast-moving car, the car changes its state from motion to rest because of the external forces of the driver's foot on the brakes. However, the passengers inside that suddenly stopped car will tend to keep moving forward because nothing is interfering with their state of rapid forward motion, that is, until the windshield or dashboard arrests their forward motion, which is why wearing seat belts improves one's safety in most situations. Away from friction and gravity, objects in space can be seen to behave exactly in accordance with Newton's first law of motion. You can apply this law to your attempts at improving your ability to see what lies ahead. If things are stable and steady, they will continue to be stable and steady unless acted on by some force. How likely is it for some force to materialize? If things are changing rapidly, they are already being acted on by some force. Find it, recognize it, and determine how that force is likely to behave. Will it continue? Will it strengthen or weaken? In other words, before looking forward, look backward. Examine the trend of the matter concerning you. What has it been doing up to the present? Once you have discovered the trend, you must ask yourself whether it has been behaving in this way because nothing has made it behave differently, or whether it is behaving this way only because something is preventing it from behaving differently. For instance, there was recently a period during which the price of gold remained remarkably steady. Ordinarily, the gold price has tended to rise during times when people perceive problems such as inflation or unrest. Gold's price might have remained steady because indeed there was little inflation and almost no civic unrest. Alternatively, gold's price may have stayed steady in spite of inflation and unrest because some other activity was counteracting the expected price rise. A little research showed that Russia was busily engaged in raising foreign currency by selling off some of their vast reserves of gold. All this new gold coming onto the market was forcing down the price that would otherwise have been driven upward by real inflation. Recognizing that it was the application of an external force that was maintaining an illusion of stability, wise investors figured out that eventually the Russians would have sold off enough to satisfy their needs. Having seen the future, the investors bought gold-related investments and prospered. Indeed, inflation was not beaten, and the Russians did stop selling off their gold. When that happened, the price of gold began to rise. Or consider this famous historical example. In his famous "Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death" speech to the Virginia Convention on March 23, 1775, Patrick Henry said, "I have but one lamp by which my feet are guided, and that is the lamp of experience. I know of no way of judging of the future but by the past. And judging by the past, I wish to know what there has been in the conduct of the British ministry for the last 10 years to justify those hopes with which gentlemen have been pleased to solace themselves and the House." All he was saying was that Britain could be counted on to do more of what it had been doing unless some force materialized that would change its approach. Unless anyone could inform Henry as to what that force might be, he was for fighting then rather than later. Paul Reichman, the Canadian business professional whose sphere of influence spans the entire globe, is someone who understands how important recalling the past is while trying to see the future. Whether it is changing the skyline of Toronto, Mexico City, or London, his almost prophetic forward vision is based on his ability to recall the past. Then he looks back in time to see what the ancients would have done, and forward to see how his actions might affect succeeding generations of Reichmans. His vision is a quality he developed early in life and still hones by studying the Talmud, a collection of Jewish thought more than 2,000 years old. "I'm still studying, but I wouldn't call myself a scholar," he says. "There's a lot of wisdom to be taken from ancient cultures. I have found that Chinese businessmen will still apply philosophy that is thousands of years old to today's events. Among Westerners, you find it less because of a certain blindness that comes from being captivated by modern science and technology. You forget you can find knowledge in other teachings, especially if you want to develop your mind. If you want to know tomorrow, you must know yesterday." Finally, here's an example from my own experience. On more than one occasion, while sailing with my family, I have had to fall back on a rough and ready form of navigation called dead reckoning. Imagine that fog closes in and obscures landmarks. One quickly identifies one's last known position on the chart. Then one tries to steer a steady compass course while maintaining a steady known speed. It now becomes an easy matter to draw a line on the chart extending from one's last known position in the direction of one's course. By taking into account currents, and by extrapolating one's speed onto that line, it is possible to predict one's exact position for any time in the future. This is another example of how one can see the future. This principle that explains how examining the past can provide a beacon into the future is what lies at the root of one of Judaism's best-known aphorisms. Whatever has been is what will be, and whatever has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new beneath the sun. There are remarkable rabbinic predictions from the 19th century that describe the future founding of the State of Israel in 1948. There is a biblical prediction that 10 anti-Semites will be hanged in one day during the year 1946. Few rabbinic scholars were surprised when the Nuremberg Tribunal hanged 10 of the Nazi defendants on one day, October 16, 1946. By clearly understanding that things change only with a cause, and that coincidences can mostly be ruled out, the task of sensing the course of future events becomes a lot more manageable. Keep in mind the patterns of time. Although no reliable accounts exist as to how the calendar came into being, some presumptions can be safely made. Mine is that some early humans watched the progression of shadows from day to day as the earth moved further into its orbit around the sun. They quickly concluded that a sort of cosmic pattern existed, one that lasted for about 365 days. They also spotted the 30-day cycle of the moon and thus were able to construct a mathematical model of time that is called a calendar. It depicted the passage of time in the form of 12 of the shorter periods fitting into one of the longer ones, and it made time far easier to grasp than it had been. The use of a calendar also granted the fortunate discoverers enormous advantages in agriculture, construction, and navigation. By thinking of the seasons as being part of a 365-day cycle, they were able to predict roughly when the rain would start falling and when the stormy weather would give way to reliable winds. To other humans who lacked insights into time, the calendar users might have appeared to be magicians. Yet all they did was identify patterns. Identifying patterns has much to do with what is thought of as intelligence. Most IQ tests routinely measure an individual's ability to identify patterns. They might ask the subject to recognize which shape does not belong in a group, or what the next number in a given sequence of numbers should be. Some people invest on the basis of having identified what they thought were patterns in the historic movements of a stock, or a group of stocks. This is not a very good idea, because it imputes some form of intelligence to price levels that are, after all, merely a system of measuring how desirable the stock is to many people. Although drawing meaningful conclusions from perceived patterns in stock prices is likely to prove reckless, drawing meaningful conclusions from larger social trends is intelligent. These larger trend patterns may very well also shape stock prices, but it is always better to understand underlying causes. Clothing fashions seem to swing pendulum-like from one extreme to another, but people who have made themselves intimately familiar with the fashion industry are able to see the future of next year's styles with some accuracy. They recognize the recurring trends and the repeating patterns that emerge whenever trends are studied. Statistically, men and women are marrying far later today than their parents did. Will this last? Probably not. At some point, the average age of marrying will start inching down again. Those who spot the turning point in advance will know how to cater to it and thereby help themselves. The Bible lists the 10 generations that separated Adam from Noah. Many people have wondered why the name of only one representative for each generation is listed. The answer is that epochs tend to follow predictable trends. For instance, three of the sequential generations mentioned are Kenan, Mahalalel, and Jared. Their names, like all names in the Torah, translate to specific meanings. Kenan implies material acquisitiveness. Mahalalel suggests spiritual quest, and Jared explicitly means cultural decline. It is not too fanciful for anyone with a longer time perspective to examine the second half of the 20th century in terms of these three cultural trends. A period of material acquisitiveness. The generation that lived and fought through World War II returned to normality with hopes of making up for the years of sacrifice. Many still harbored painful recollections of the Depression years that preceded the war. For whatever reason, the years immediately following World War II were certainly the years that launched America's love affair with material acquisition. The size of homes skyrocketed during that time, and the number of square feet dedicated to the bathroom grew at an even faster pace. Two cars began to become common for many American families. Appliances filled the kitchens, and savings accounts started swelling. Material acquisition began to become a value in and of itself. It could truly have been called the epoch of material acquisition. As so often happens, this period sowed the seeds for the next. A period of spiritual quest. Somewhere during the 1960s came the birth of the so-called hippie movement. A full-scale sociological survey isn't necessary in order to see the basic pattern. Whether it was the way the hippies adopted clothing their parents would have donated to a charity, or the way they rejected the conventional progression of study leading to job and career, the hippies were clearly intent on replacing what they saw as their parents' materialism with some form of spiritual quest. Their music gradually switched from the Beatles' I Want to Hold Your Hand of the early 1960s to music that reflected obsession with exotic Eastern cults that promised spiritual nirvana. I suspect that growing drug use among the children of the generation of material acquisition was part of the same spiritual quest. First, look at alcohol, and then draw conclusions, perhaps valid, for mind-altering chemicals. For the most part, when you enjoy an alcoholic drink, it is not in quite the same way you enjoy a plate of delicious food. The food can be said to be satisfying a very physical need, but until addiction sets in, your body has no physical need for alcohol as it does for food. No, when you drink, you are satisfying a spiritual need. I was led to this view by my own faith, and indeed by others too, which sacramentalizes the drinking of wine. There is clearly a strong link between alcohol and the human spirit. People turn to alcohol because of a spiritual need. For some unfortunate people, alcohol becomes a spiritual anesthetic to dull the emotional pain of their existence. Many suffer this condition while living in great comfort and physical sufficiency. In January 1961, the great psychiatrist Carl Jung wrote a letter from Switzerland, where he lived, to Bill Wilson, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. In this letter, Jung referred to a patient called Roland H. His craving for alcohol was the equivalent on a low level of the spiritual thirst of our being for wholeness expressed in medieval language, the union with God. Jung worried about referring to God in a scientific and therapeutic context, and next